But the seconds lengthen and still I dare it. Training was good, I tell him.
Lee. It's begun to feel as if the new Pythian's ultimatum is hanging over the city like a knife. Late summer is a time of year I've learned to dread, associated as it has been for as long as I can remember with memories of Palace Day. But this year, for the first time, the city shares my unease. I can't shake the feeling that however Callipolis responds to the Pythians, I'll feel responsible. Because Atreus may not have read it that way, but Julia's message wasn't just intended as an ultimatum for Callipolis. It was also intended, very specifically, as a final chance for me. A final chance to seek a solution short of war. And with an unsparked fleet, how can we, in good conscience, not consider... Lee, you need to train. It's Kor who forces me to commit to a time and a place for him and Krissa to begin training me. I agree to it with a kind of disorientation. The First Rider tournament, to take place the weekend before Palace Day, has faded in and out of my awareness since the Starved Rock attack. Partly because my growing anxiety about Palace Day overshadows it. But also partly because when I think of the tournament, Julia's words return with all their seductive force. Do you want First Rider so much you can taste it? Annie will be a challenging opponent, but my real opponent, my real challenge, is Palace Day on the other end of it. And Julia, daughter of Crethon, waiting for me to change my mind. The First Rider tournament isn't what I'm worried about. But I'd be a fool not to train. The first day we all share a free block. Krissa and I arrive at the Eyrie before Kor. It's the first time we've been alone since the Lycian ball. Krissa, that night... Krissa puts up both hands like she's holding me off and offers a strained smile. Whatever you're about to say, I'm pretty sure I already know. For a moment we look at each other and then, to my surprise, Krissa ducks her head and laughs sheepishly. And then I do too. It was really nice. She smiles tentatively. Yeah, it was. I mean it as an ending, a moment of closure. But all the same, when she sits down beside me just a little bit closer than usual, my stomach skips, and the moment doesn't feel so closed. Sorry I'm late. Kor has landed. He dismounts from Morana, sends her back into the air to circle with Phaedra and Palor, and takes a seat on my other side. Krissa clears her throat and produces a calendar on which, 10 days from today, is circled the date of the First Rider tournament. A week later, Palace Day. I brought a schedule, she says. Thought it would help us plan. Only 10 days. 10 days to train. And a little over that to call the Pythians off. And if not, we'll see the full force of their wrath, and we, unsparked, will have little choice but to bear it. Lee, what do you want to focus on? We can map out a drill schedule based on what you need. I rouse myself, then hesitate. With most opponents, it's easy to home in on the best ways to beat them. But the fact is, Annie has no convenient weaknesses to exploit. Kor speaks first. Spillovers. Word is, Annie's training with power. It's the first news that has been able to surprise me since the beacons lit the night of the Lyceum Ball. Annie training with power? Since when?
Since Starved Rock, I think.
Kor's hesitation before giving this information is not lost on me. Nor is the way Krissa suddenly busies herself with her calendar, rubbing her forehead with the tips of her fingers. Her shoulders are drawn together with unspoken censure that I feel like a cold draft of air. It was that bad? I ask them, looking between them. In the armory. I've already felt the answer to this question, but ask in the dim hope that they'll say otherwise. They don't. Kor squints. Krissa lifts her shoulders. Her answer is hesitant.
I can see why you made the call, but I can also see how she might have found it patronizing.
Starved Rock has begun to feel like the name for a catalogue of all the mistakes I could make in a single night.
Anyway, Kor says,
abruptly, with the air of barreling out of the silence his news has created.
My point was,
Maybe you should give spillovers a try too? Krissa is nodding, shrugging off her disapproval, suddenly brisk and tapping her pen on the calendar.
Cor's right, they might work for you.
I shake my head. I don't do spillovers. Cor hums, frustrated.
Why?
Krissa asks. I like to stay in control. Krissa turns and looks at me, her eyebrow lifts. I blush. Cor glances between us, searching. Krissa goes back to her schedule.
Well, at any rate, you should be prepared for styles of attack associated with spillovers. We can make a list of good drills for that, and then we'll just cycle through them.
Don't forget contact charges, Cor adds, knocking his shoulder and fist against my side to demonstrate. It'll be a same-breed match, there'll be fair game.
Krissa and Cor alternate running drills and playing opposite me. Their experience as squadron leaders means that both manage drills comfortably and well, attentive to intensity and pacing. I break a sweat almost immediately. Palor is soon burning hot with exertion, and the hour passes before any of us know it. It's almost possible, training under their guidance, to stop thinking about Starved Rock. And Julia. And everything I've done wrong. Everything I might be about to do wrong. After training, I finish unsaddling Palor and go to the Skyfish Caves, to Phaedra's nest. Krissa is alone, scrubbing Phaedra down, her golden hair stained with sweat and half falling from its braid. I just wanted to say, I shouldn't have. The shouldn't have on the tip of my tongue is about Annie, a confession of guilt in the face of Krissa's muted disappointment, but then other shouldn't haves crowd in as well. I shouldn't have just for Krissa. I shouldn't have kissed her on the palace ramparts just to feel less alone. Even if she's pretty and makes me laugh and is so clearly interested. And the worst one that I can't undo, can't even confess, whose magnitude has the power to make the edges of my vision blacken. I shouldn't have let Holmes take down the aerial guard the night of the Lyceum Ball. Krissa pauses, looking at me, Phaedra's brush dripping ash-dark suds down her mother-of-pearl side. And then she doesn't ask what I mean or even try to disagree with me. No. You shouldn't have. The relief I feel to hear it said eases the breath from my lungs. Krissa sets the brush down in the bucket and approaches me, until she's standing close, too close. Close enough that I remember exactly what it was like to kiss those lips, to wrap my fingers in her hair. Behind her, Phaedra lets out a sigh like a purr, her back arching, wings widening, and then stands very still, as if every nerve of her arched body is alert. Like Krissa looking at me. It's the language of the dragon's body that makes my mouth go dry, even if it's Krissa's murmured breath that I feel when she speaks. People do that. Things they shouldn't. Mistakes. You make them, and so do I. A half hour later, I let myself into the boys' washroom with still hot blood to find Cor alone, scrubbing ash slowly from his neck over a basin of water. His hazel eyes find me in the reflection of the mirror.
I'm not an idiot.
I freeze on the threshold.
I'm going to say one thing, and then have it your way, and we won't talk about it. I would kill anyone who ever hurt my sisters. You're my friend, Lee, and I follow you into hell as my fleet commander. But I think of Krissa like a sister. And she deserves better than to be your fallback plan. Do you understand me?
Maybe it's because I understand exactly what he means. Maybe it's because, sick from so many weights of guilt I'd only just found some relief from, I'm not inclined for more. Or maybe, most of all, because half an hour ago Krissa looked me in the eye, as good as called me a mistake, and then kissed me anyway. I hear myself give the kind of answer I've seen Cor punch people for.
If you're worried about Krissa getting hurt, maybe you should talk to her.
Cor snaps the towel back on the drying rack and exhales. I feel myself tensing, my fists clenching, suddenly wanting the fight. But then all he does is shake his head. His shoulders slump with defeat.
I did.
I train with Krissa and Cor almost every day. Afterward, if there's time, while my blood is still singing from flight and exertion, Krissa and I find each other. In Phaedra's nest or Palor's, their presence, an edge of unreason that makes it just a little easier to forget better resolve. Because I share all cause reservations until the moment that I disregard them. Then I lose myself for a few lingering moments in the kind of oblivion that approximates happiness. Always later, but with slowly decreasing conviction, I tell myself that Core is right and that it has to stop. And the rest of the time, the world spins with uncertainty. I move from meetings with naval officials to coastal patrols to morale visits with unease that I am unable to voice. What is waiting for us after the First Rider tournament and Palace Day? What greater bloodshed for Kallipolis that the Pythians hold over our heads? Every spare moment I weigh it, the price of fighting versus the price of turning. Every time the calculation comes, more or less, to the same conclusion Atreus made so unforgivingly in his office after the attack, that no compromise is possible, not from the Pythians, and not from Atreus. But though the calculation comes out the same every time, I still feel doubt clouding it. If I have even the chance of preventing more violence and don't pursue it, what will that be, if not more blood on my hands? Further starved rocks to regret.
Annie.
I've begun spending every spare second in the arena, training my answer to every jittering nerve and rise of anticipation. Every other part of my life fades as I focus on the one point of my future that remains in my control. I have the feeling of being increasingly, tantalizingly close. Victory within sight. Racing the clock of my own courage and resolve to make it over the finish line before I falter. Power and I practice daily after class. It is as though Ayla and I are unlearning everything Gorin taught from the ground up. We learn to rely not on the stirrups and rein and bit to communicate, but on the wordless impulses that move between us, unfiltered. In the moment, it's exhilarating to trust another being so completely. Afterward, the exhaustion hits with a memory of vulnerability. It becomes difficult in the extricating to distinguish Ayla's memories from my own. But the days add up, and even as our connection deepens, still we can't initiate spillover independently. Which means I continue to rely on power for provocation. The beginning of training becomes an increasingly excruciating kind of ritual, evolving as power and I work our way back through memories. Though the spillovers can be provoked by positive feelings, they're not the ones readily available to our mining. At power's prompting, I talk about my botched morale visit to Holbin, about the memo from the Ministry of Propaganda before the Fourth Order tournament, and then we start on memories from our earliest years in the Corps, the things that used to happen before Lee reported Gorin to Atreus. Power's take on these memories is different from mine. "Do you remember," Power recalls, "how Gorin used to call off drills before any of the girls or peasants got to practice, then humiliate you for not being able to do them later? I always thought that was hilarious. Do you remember that time I got Duck's own dragon to bite his leg? Probably the crowning achievement of our first year, even if it meant Kor and Lee beating the hell out of me later. Duck was hobbling for days. Do you remember how Gorin always put you on dragon dung shoveling duty? What was the reason he gave you for that one?" Power is grinning as sweat trickles down his forehead, as if he already knows the answer. I give it anyway, hating Power as I always do in these moments, aching for the spillover that's just out of reach. "He said I cleaned better." "He was right, though," Power points out, "and that's enough to send me over." As much as I come away from these sessions furious, furious with Power, furious with the memories, furious, there's also triumph. Because for the first time in my life, the old wounds are useful. The fury gives me Ayla, And when we're together, like this, we're powerful. At such a price, the memories of weakness finally serve a purpose, and once used, they never hurt with the same strength again. Eventually there comes a day when power asks, "Do you want to try going all the way back?" I'm caught off guard. "What?" "You know, your family, what happened to them. It always works for me." My look of confusion must betray me, because he adds impatient, "Not my adopted family, my real one. When my dad left my mum pregnant to die in a poorhouse, and I got taken in by the people she cleaned for." Oh. It's the first time Power has brought up the past that Dora alluded to at the Lycean Ball. But now that he does, he refers to it as if it's something I've always known. He flashes a grin at me, too wide, and lifts his fingers to massage the damp stubble of his hair as the late summer sun beats down. "I always figured you were pissed too," he says. Ayla is snorting, nuzzling my side, and I move my fingers up to scratch behind her horned jaw. I consider, searching myself for the emotions Power describes. Though I do find the memory of anger and pain, I also find that the emotions themselves have faded. "You're not," Power observes, watching me. I raise and lower my shoulders. "It happened a long time ago," I say. "It's just over." There is something liberating about that realization, even if it leaves me feeling strangely empty. Over. Time has left me with, if not peace, at least a dimmer kind of pain, not the kind that has the power to bring Ayla close. A strange expression is on Power's face, his usual scorn mixed with something else, almost jealousy or bitterness. "Good for you," he says. But from his tone, I'm pretty sure that's not what he's thinking. An hour later, our training finished, I make my way in exhausted silence through the Aurelian cave corridor, back up to the cloister, and stop at the sound of disturbance. It comes from Palor's nest. The lanterns inside are lit. I round the corner unreflectingly, then stop dead. All at once, the sounds I heard, which I should have understood immediately, make sense. A girl's voice giggling, murmured half words, an inhaled breath. Lee and Krissa, braced against the cave wall, wrapped in an embrace. For a second longer than I have reason to, I find myself looking at the way he holds her, one hand moving down her hip, tightening on the leather of the flame suit, the other winding in her hair to tilt back her head as he kisses her neck. As in his sparring, the same rough purpose guided by gentle precision, the same complete control. Mouth dry, face hot, I flee. And then alone, I learn that this is what is meant by desire. This lingering awareness of my own body, this ache to find him again, to feel rather than to see those hands and those lips. The blasphemy of it, to feel it for Lee. And this is how it hurts, to want someone and see them in the arms of someone else. I spend the next 2 days watching, like some gossiping Lyceum girl, and hating myself for it. Watching every interaction he and Krissa have, whenever they smile at each other or laugh at each other's jokes, or brush against each other in passing. I watch, and I try to decide if I'm imagining that Lee, whose mood has darkened since the Starved Rock attack to almost unbroken silence, seems happier at least in her company. And I try to tell myself that it's good if he's found a reason to smile. and that the thought shouldn't hurt. That the first rider tournament is all that matters, and that this is a shallow, superficial distraction. It's Chryssa who eventually stops my agonized speculating. Annie, I need to tell you something. She's found me in the dorm, alone. I know from her tone at once what it will be about. She has dispensed with her squadron leader voice and sits on the bed across from mine, looking grave. For a moment, the only sound is the gulls crying outside the open window. Then I decide to spare us both. I already know. Chryssa tilts her head, her grave expression faltering. You do? I nod. Well, I was going to ask if it's okay with you. I think of the way it felt, like a knife twisting up into my ribs, the sight of Lee's body pressed against someone else, his lips on another's skin. Why wouldn't it be okay? My voice is like ice. Chryssa sounds tired. You know why, Annie. Lee's free to kiss whomever he likes. You're as good a choice as any. Chryssa stiffens as if I'd slapped her. That was unkind, she says softly. I feel the force of her reprimand like a lash. I remember the evening after making finalist, when Chryssa opened the door to my infirmary ward and brought a party with her. Of the hours she spent with me on the arena ramparts, coaching my public speaking at the cost of her free time, of the care she took, in the lead-up to the Lycian ball to ease my discomfort. Chryssa doesn't deserve this anger. She goes on with forced calm. I am trying to say this. If you don't want... If this upsets you, I will call it off. If this upsets you. I think of a boy from another lifetime, making sure I had enough to eat, teaching me what it felt like not to be hungry. The years I spent sparring with that boy daily, honing his abilities as I honed my own. Those few minutes in the middle of the Lycian ball, when we danced and my world stood still. And then I remember that it is this same boy whose face so often, when I look at it, chills me with the shadow of another's, and that I've been training for the first rider tournament as I've never trained in my life because of the burning desire, finally discovered, to step out of his shadow and into the light. Lee doesn't belong to me, I tell Chryssa, and if this is what he wants, he should have it. I wait until she's gone before I break down. Increasingly desperate headlines in both the People's Paper and the Gold Gazette predict that our fleet's sparking is imminent. State-sponsored editorials enthusiastically reaffirm the new regime's superiority to the rule of the Dragon Lords, one half of an argument whose other side Chryssa and I overheard in the streets after Atreus's speech. The doubt implicit: what good is an aerial fleet ridden by commoners if it can't defend us? The Ministry of Propaganda's answer is made clear enough, though I learn of it not from the paper, but from our poetry professor 4 days before the first rider tournament. Dragontongue poetry is one of the few courses to have continued into the summer months. Guardians have been expected to keep up our studies, although with our wartime obligations expanding, it's difficult for the professors to get work of any quality out of us anymore. Tyndale hasn't been understanding about it, and today he turns out to be in an especially foul temper.
No, that's not quite right, Cor, Tyndale says, 5 minutes into the lesson. In fact, that was all wrong.
Power lets out a snicker that he doesn't even bother to suppress. The sound of his voice, which I now associate with goads to the point that it makes my stomach jump, reminds me that we'll be on the Eyrie together again to train within the hour. Kor has folded his arms, scowling at Tyndale. In his Guardian ground uniform, with ash still caked to the back of his neck from a naval drill that ran late into the morning, he has the look of someone who has no time left for poetry or poetry professors.
Antigone, fix it!
I look down at Kor's line with misgiving. Most of the time I can make sense of the Aurelian cycle, but I haven't had time to properly prepare a translation in weeks. What free time I've had hasn't been spent on homework. I start to sight read a translation of the line, but Tyndale stops me before I can get halfway through.
That will do. Is any Guardian still capable of making a passable translation these days, or are you all too busy giving speeches to frightened class ions?
By now, a few Lyceum students have their hands in the air, some like Hannah Lund, glancing at the Guardians anxiously, but Tyndale ignores them.
Lotus?
Lotus has been slumping, flushed from the summer heat, over his desk. He lurches upright and starts reading his own translation, but he barely translates two words before Tyndale cuts him off too.
Lee,
he says with finality. I know, because I've been keeping track, that this is the first time Tyndale's ever called on Lee. Lee, who's been reading along in the primer with his forehead resting on his palm, reacts slowly. He lowers his palm, raises his head, straightens up. And then he stares at Tyndale. His fingers press hard against the open primer, the tips going white, and he doesn't reach for the notebook lying beneath it. Since I saw him with Chryssa in the nests, I've stopped speaking to Lee altogether. Even as I have become aware of every shadow of his body's definition, discernible through his uniform, as if a switch has been flipped in my thoughts that can't be turned back off. But now I notice also how Tyndale's attention has made Lee tense from head to foot. He hasn't appeared so alarmed in Tyndale's class since our very first day.
I didn't do my homework, Lee says. And then he adds with contempt bordering on anger,
like you said, I was too busy giving speeches to frightened class ions. A ripple of surprise goes around the room at his tone. When Tyndale speaks, his voice is crisp, carefully enunciated.
Well then, why don't you try sight reading?
Lee curls his hands into fists and looks down at the text beneath them. For a moment he's silent, but then he starts listing words aloud, throwing out the Kalish equivalents of each word without any effort to make sense of them. The enemy has walls, rushes in the deep, away from summit. Tyndale throws an eraser at Lee's head. Lee ducks and the eraser sails past. There's a thud as the wooden side hits the far wood-paneled wall, powdering it with chalk. Tyndale is still bearing down on him, and now he stands right in front of Lee's desk. Neither of them is pretending anything but fury now. Despite all the reasons I've stopped speaking to Lee, at the moment, as I watch Tyndale approach him, it's Tyndale I feel hatred for. Knee-jerk, fierce, protective. As if a poetry professor's triumphant sneer were danger enough to wipe every other grudge from my mind. Stay away from him.
No,
Tyndale says. Lee seems to be paralyzed, wide-eyed, waiting to see what Tyndale will say next. And Tyndale himself seems to be struggling to decide. And then as I watch them, as I hold my breath, the case of a single elusive noun becomes clear in my mind. And just like that, I realize I have it. My voice is clear. Alas, Flee, Dragonborn, you and your family. Flee from the flames. The enemy has your walls. The city falls in ruin from its height. For a moment, the room is strangely still. The sound of my own voice, so unusually loud in my ears, lingers in the air. The tragedy of the line washes over me, beautiful and heartbreaking. Then the moment passes. Lee closes his eyes and sinks back in his seat. A strange expression fills his face, tightening it. Tyndale seems to deflate. He turns from Lee, disoriented, and looks down at the books spread across his desk, gathering his thoughts. Yes, he says distantly, moving away from Lee. Yes, yes. Very good, Antigone. Behind his back, people are glancing at each other, exchanging confused looks. Lee lowers his face into his palms and exhales. I should tell you, Tyndale says, turning back to us abruptly. He holds up his own copy of the poem, an old leather-bound version that looks like he's had it since his own school days. The Aurelian cycle was officially banned today by the censorship committee. I feel the pulse of the line in my ears again, the terrible beauty of it. Lee lowers his hands from his face and straightens slowly. Lotus speaks up hesitantly. You mean banned for the lower class metals? Restricted to the Lyceum Library? No. It was already restricted. Now it's being purged. Why? Lotus asks. Tyndale grimaces. It was decided that the poem promotes values that are contrary to the national interest. I remember rounds with Ornby in the censorship office over a month ago telling me, don't want to give the lower class metals these kinds of ideas. They'll start wanting the Dragon Lords back. They can't handle nuance like you can. Wasn't he right? I've heard the murmured discontent in the streets. I've seen the editorials in the People's Paper urging reason. But even as a newcomer to Dragon Tongue literature, even as someone who hasn't grown up hearing the Aurelian cycle quoted as readily as speech, the idea of banning it is unthinkable. It's taken too much of my heart already, in this class alone. Even if some fools are misinterpreting it, how could Atreus allow such a thing? He enrolled the Fourth Order Riders in this course. He quotes the Aurelian cycle in class with us effortlessly. Clearly he shares my love for its beauty, its tradition. But that's not the same as prioritizing it. I remind myself, Atreus led a coup against his own masters that resulted in their massacre. The same dragonborn that the Aurelian cycle portrays as hubristic and godlike, Atreus brought to their knees. He doesn't have a history of standing on tradition, even if he does have a taste for dragon tongue poetry. The official announcement will be in the Gold Gazette tomorrow, Tyndale says. Raids will be conducted throughout the summer, and confiscated copies will be destroyed. Needless to say, the status of this class has become uncertain. Cor mouths, thank the dragon, at Lee, whose face is slack, and doesn't return his grin. Tyndale has us read a little more, but after hearing a few more lines of poor translations, he dismisses us. As we get up to leave, he goes over and stands next to Lee's desk, silent, but his meaning clear. Lee remains seated, his arms folded, as the rest of the students leave. Power catches up with me in the corridor, breaking away from a group of gold girls, and we exit into the Lyceum courtyard together. This late in the summer, the green would usually be full of students lounging on the grass and pretending to read, but in the wake of Starved Rock, it's unnaturally empty. As if leisure under an open sky is no longer possible.
That was fishy as hell, he comments. I stop dead and round on him. What? Power pauses too, lifts an eyebrow. You tell me, Annie. For a moment we stand completely still as we stare at each other, and my heart begins to race as I take in his muted, sneaking smile as he regards my alarm and plays stupid. What has he guessed? What does he know? This is dangerous. Powers made no secret of hating Lee, not since they were children, not since Lee put himself in opposition to every single one of Powers' moves of assertion within the core. I remember the sound of Power coughing while Lee held him and Core punched. Lee's identity in the hands of Power would be a disaster. Power says with a half glance at his own bare shoulder. Oh, dragons, I forgot my bag. I guess I'll have to double back. His tone is unmistakable. He's toying with me. But all I can think of in this moment is to make the move he's prompting. I'll get it for you. Power just studies me, his smile widening. Whatever you like, Annie. See you on the airy. Right, I answer, barely hearing myself. I walk back into the classroom building, and though I should feel nothing, I'm sick with dread. No, I think as I approach. No, 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 I don't want this. I've never wanted this. It was enough for him to say, "You're not a fool for trusting me." It was enough for Tyndale to slip that name once, Leo, and never say it again. It's enough for me to want First Rider, and for that to have nothing to do with who he was once or where he came from. I don't need this now. And the fear that is less rational, that is worse than any of that, that was, perhaps, the point of Power's game from the start. What if I don't like what I'm about to hear?
Lee.
Julia's words from our last meeting. Watch and see when we exert pressure how this vision will splinter. Then we will revisit whether you find it noble. Is this the beginning of that splintering? This edict banning the words that have guided our people for centuries?
It's been a while since we talked,
Tyndale says, after he closes the door behind him. Dragon tongue again. For the first time, I find myself glad Tyndale seeks a confrontation. My guilt has found a target and transformed to anger. I answer in Kalish. Yes, it has. Was it you who told them that the Guardians would be in full attendance at the Lycian Ball? Tyndale, standing, leans his palms on his desk. The room is so warm, the heat in it so stuffy from the summer, that drops of sweat darken his white shirt beneath the arms. He tugs at the neck of his collar, loosening it.
My dear boy, it's not as if the Lycian Ball or its guest list was a secret.
And I'm not the only member of the Gold Estate sympathetic to the Pythian cause. Tyndale nods to the Aurelian cycle, lying dog-eared on the desk beside him.
After this, I imagine you can see why.
An image in my mind, smoke rising from a lonely island off the northern coast. If this is the vision splintering, it's still better than what the Pythians did to Starved Rock.
There's more to civilization than poetry.
Tyndale sneers. He lifts a hand and flicks it, dismissing.
Don't tell me a few dead fishermen were enough to turn your stomach. Unarmed civilians, casualties of war,
an unfortunate price. I stare at him, hatred coiling in my stomach. How dare he, this academic, this scholar who spends his days scanning verse and picking apart figures of speech, refer to what we saw on Starved Rock as a price? As if the loss of lives can be set on a numeric scale, quantifiable like currency. But, Tyndale goes on, if it's a price that makes you squeamish, now is your time to reconsider. I'm shaking my head, as if with my body I can force out the thoughts that have already been plaguing my mind.
I should report you.
I tell him. I should report you. For a moment, we stare at each other, neither of us so much as blinking. I get to my feet, reach for my bag, sling it over my shoulder, fingers shaking, though I will myself to calm. But as I turn to leave, Tyndale speaks again. Have you thought about what will happen if you refuse her? Not to the civilians, to you. When I don't answer, Tyndale does for me. I've paused, half turned from him, my hand gripping my shoulder strap so tightly the leather bites my fingers. You'll be in combat against your own relatives, your cousins. You'd be killing your own family. Tyndale drives the words home hard, like he's determined to jolt me with them. She's First Rider, Lee. Their champion, their fleet commander. It won't just be them you'll have to go against. It will be her. He must find what he's looking for in my expression because his own has become triumphant. We await your next letter. I have the feeling of ground slipping, and it's against this feeling that I growl my answer with all the conviction that I wish I felt. I have nothing more to say to them. I turn on my heel, wrench open the door onto the hallway, to find Annie standing on the other side of it, white-faced and round-eyed. What did she hear? What language were we speaking in? Dragon tongue. Which she must have realized, but is also less likely to have been able to understand when muffled through the crack of a door. What are you doing here? I forgot something, she says acidly. Shouldn't you be off playing spillover with power? Her face colors. Shouldn't you be off sparring with Chrissa? I'd meant to pass her, but we both stopped, and there's only about a foot between us. I feel like shaking her. You're in my way, I say, through gritted teeth. Annie's eyes are bright. She lets out a soft laugh, full of anger. What are you going to do? She whispers. Order me to move? It's enough for me to jerk sideways, and for her to pass without a word.
Annie.
We await your next letter. Tyndale's words. Lee's low-voiced answer. The dragon tongue too fast for me to understand. The door bursting open and Lee's furious face draining as he sees me. What was Lee's answer to Tyndale? Out on the Eyrie, Power says, Well? Our dragons wait for us, clawing the ground with impatience. Standing this close to Ayla, I can feel the spillover a breath away. For the first time since we've begun training together, I realize the pathway is within my control. At the same time, as close as I am to spillover, the part of me considering Power is completely calm. I got your bag. If that's what you're asking, can we start? Call me a peasant like you did last time. Let's see if that works. Power scowls at me, disappointed. And then, as he starts hurling insults at me, first in Kalish, then Dragon Tongue, I tune him out. I let myself think everything that I've been holding in contact with them. Lee's in contact with Pythians. Through our bloody poetry professor. How long has this been happening? Has it been happening all along? After the sighting, he told me I wasn't a fool to trust him, and I believed him. Ayla's mind close to me, the barriers breaking, my fingers stretching up to press between her eyes at the ridge of her amber-scaled temple. Should I have? I believe the words Lee said were ones he meant, but in the wake of a disaster like Starved Rock and New Pythos's threat hanging over us like a storm about to drop, in the face of almost certain violence and death against family. If they're in contact. Surely even Lee has limits for his stomach to hold fast. The barrier's breaking. Ayla's mind sliding into mine, her slitted eyes the only thing I see. In the last few weeks I've let myself want to win First Rider. Let myself think I deserved to want it. But what if there's more to it than that? What if I've got to make First Rider? Is Lee compromised? Ayla and I become one, and we are ready to spar. Afterward, head clear, ash scrubbed from my face, I take stock of the situation. Tyndale is compromised. Lee is possibly compromised. And I've no idea what Power knows or guesses. In almost certain threat of war, with such knowledge at my fingertips, what is my obligation? I go to the inner palace, make my gamble, and file a single report.
Chapter 11. The First Rider Tournament. Lee.
The morning of the First Rider Tournament, I wake from fitful sleep where memories blur with dreams. Sparring with Annie when we were first learning how, planning our escapes, huddled in the closet in the orphanage. My father and his dragon in flight. Weaving in and out of these over and over again, Julia. I pray to the long-dead gods that this tournament brings sense to you. I sit next to Krissa and Kor at breakfast. Across the room, on the opposite side of the refectory, sit Annie and Duck. We haven't spoken since we met in the hallway outside Tyndale's classroom 4 days ago. The room vibrates with a barely suppressed excitement. The other riders seem to know better than to voice their anticipation in front of either Annie or me. Except, of course, Power, who takes a seat across from me to say, "Do you know what Annie had me call her so she could spill over?" "Get away from us," Kor says. Power tells me, then watches for my reaction. Annie across the room glances over at us and then stubbornly away again. How, I wonder, how could she have stooped to this to train with this imbecile? Without acknowledging either of them, I drain my glass and rise. "I'll see you later," I tell Kor and Krissa. The armory is silent, empty. This time of year, it collects heat during the day and never quite has time to cool off during the night, so it's already unpleasantly stuffy as I change into my flame suit. I'm halfway through buckling on armor, beginning to think we won't overlap at all, when the door opens and Annie comes in. "Hey." "Hey." I can think of nothing else to say. And though Annie is one of the few people I've ever been comfortable with in silence, right now it's not the kind of silence that's comfortable. It's the silence of two people not speaking to each other. Then, in that silence, Annie reaches for her flame suit and freezes. Her back is turned. I can't see what she's looking at. As gingerly as someone removing an unwanted insect from a plate of food, she pulls a sealed letter out of her cubby and rests it unopened on the bench beside her. "What?" "It's from the ministry," she says, her back still turned to me. I straighten. Despite the residual cool that's distanced us since Tyndale's class, the news shocks me into anger. Now? They're still pulling this on her. For a moment I stare at her back as the discomfort creeps in. Maybe the last time this happened I was the person to say something. But today? Now? What is there possibly for me to say as her opponent? But it turns out I don't have to say anything. Steel has entered Annie's voice like I've never heard it before. "I'm not reading it." She yanks on her flame suit without looking at the letter again, and when her armor is on, she heads out to the nests without me. A half hour later, we're both on the Eyrie. The blue of the late summer sky is blotted with billowing cumulus clouds, moving fast in a brisk breeze. They hang low, some of them even at the level of Pytho's keep. Standing on the Eyrie, surrounded by stands that are completely full and cheering in a deafening roar, feeling the sweat begin to trickle beneath layers of armor and leather, I look up at the racing sun-swept sky and feel the first leapings of anticipation. Skies like this are meant to be flown in. At the mouth of the cave, we summon our dragons and wait together. There's silence again, but it's a different kind of silence, as if Annie, too, is aching to get into the air. Our backs are turned toward those watching on the Eyrie, and we face the stands that have quieted with expectation. I feel that stillness awaken all my senses. Yes, this is it. Finally. After years of wanting and waiting and training, after dreams lost and regained, I am here. Vying for first rider as if the whole world hadn't changed since I first imagined winning the title. Palor and Ayla alight on either side of us. Their anticipation fuels ours. Palor is twitching with impatience to take off, and I have to yank on his reins to hold him still while I double-check his stirrups, his girth, his bridle. I mount, pull on my helmet, and place my hand on my visor. Before I lower it, I look over at Annie for the final check-in. She has mounted and is bent low on Ayla's back with her head lowered, one gloved hand pressed against the side of Ayla's scaled neck. Their eyes are closed. A ripple goes through them both. Ayla's wings twitch open and Annie lifts her head. When she opens her eyes and looks at me, her pupils are dilated. The familiar becomes alien and my uncertainty becomes foreboding. She nods at me, I nod at her, and we lower our visors. Then we're off, into the air, at last. We leave behind the eyrie, the arena, the palace, and the city. The wind on which the cumulus surfs catches the wings of our dragons like sails snapping taut. We assume position, facing each other at a distance of 10 meters, wings beating against the currents of air to stay in place. All around us, clouds are shifting and reforming in the summer light. Distantly, through the roaring wind, we hear the bell ring. We charge, full speed, straight at each other. Adrenaline floods in, heady and familiar. We're close, closer, too close. At the last second, as we veer and fire and swerve, and the heat of Ayla's blast streams across my back as I flatten myself against Palor to escape it, and we ride a surging gust of wind out of range, I think, I know this. This is Antigone sur Ayla. Every bit of them. They're not alien. They are simply more themselves. And Palor and I know them in our bones. I rein him round to engage again and see Ayla rising, gaining height, and at once we surge upward to race her for the advantage, and I can't resist a wind-swallowed cry of sheer delight. I've missed this. This is how it's supposed to be. She stalls on a hard gust and uses it to leverage a plunge down. Palor and I roll into a dive. She follows, hot on my tail as we plummet through drifts of cumulus and ripples of turbulence, and my ears are popping from the kind of changes in pressure that only happen when the ground is something you're accelerating toward with all the speed you can muster. We roll again, come at Annie from the side rather than below, and hit Ayla with a contact charge. Ayla's descent becomes, from our momentum, a sideways roll as our dragons struggle in a locked embrace. It seems that the world spins, the horizon rotates on an axis, the cumulus churns around us as it streams past and reforms. Ayla gains traction, sinks talons into Palor's side, and he screeches and releases her. They take off, and we pursue. It goes on. I could go on doing it forever. I want to. Annie and Ayla's spillover makes their responses faster, their instincts surer, their assaults harder. And I love it. Palor and I are pushing ourselves like we haven't in years, every nerve alive as we strain to match Annie and Ayla. The challenge works on us like a drug. We're bursting through barriers that I'd previously thought of as our ceilings, and we push them back. Because even when they're flying their best, we know their mistakes. We know their weaknesses. We've helped them hone their abilities with drill after drill for as long as we've flown. And they know us. So it becomes a struggle to peel the layers back, to probe for weakness, to expose a mistake. A performance of something intimate. These are the things I alone can find in her and she alone can find in me. She finds my weakness first. I risk opening my guard for a half instant in order to take aim, a move I can usually pull off without the other rider even noticing. But today, Annie does. Her shot sears across my exposed shoulder, a penalty hit. It's the first penalty I've ever received in a public tournament. The shock of it sobers me at once, and the breathless exhilaration I've been riding falters. We reset. I open my coolant valves, easing the pain searing my shoulder. Distantly below, the bell rings, we charge again. This time it becomes a contact charge at once. The dragons scrabble, fighting to get a clear shot at the other's rider, and then as we push off again, I catch Annie ceding just a little too much horizontal leverage, a classic Annie mistake, and I have her. She shies, it only grazes her, a penalty hit on the arm. That's it. We reset, Annie opens her coolant shafts, and we charge again. This time, when we ram, I head in sideways, hoping to gain centripetal momentum. It's not a move most riders know how to predict or respond to, but she responds just fine. She swerves, we misfire, and both leave ourselves exposed. In the opening, Annie fires again. She lands a second penalty across my leg. It is full heat, an intended kill shot. My leg sears with it, and I let out a grunt of pain, which Annie hears. "You all right?" she calls. "Fine." I'm furious with myself. I back out of range to release coolant valves and reset, and all the while my mind is racing with a single panicked thought. We're on our second penalty. For the first time, the reality really hits. I could lose. If we keep flying like we just did, I'm going to. Annie could make first rider. How is this the first time, though I've known all along that she'd be my most formidable opponent, that this would be my hardest match, that this thought really hits home? Pallor ripples beneath me. The barrier between us has thinned as our emotions have risen. I can feel our anger at our mistakes, our tiredness, pushing us dangerously close to a spillover. I fight to stay in control. The dragons are facing each other, reset for a charge. Pallor is heaving beneath me, the exertion of the match finally taking its toll. I can feel it wearing on me as well. Annie and Ayla have been practicing at this spillover-induced intensity for a month. We haven't. We need to calm down, refocus, and finish this before we're too drained. But to do that, we need to buy time. The bell rings. Annie surges forward, and instead of meeting her, I rein Pallor round to a retreat. He growls and resists like he hates me for it, and I don't blame him because I hate myself a little bit too. We plunge into the nearest cumulus and keep going through the heart of the clouds, keeping cover in their whiteness. I check behind my shoulder over and over again, but see no sign of her. The cumulus have thickened as we sparred. We're in and out of seamless stretches of white, so much that it begins to feel like clear patches are the exception rather than the rule. Have I lost her? We burst into a clearing, free of clouds either overhead or beneath. The arena is far below. Even Pytho's keep is distant and small. We're surrounded on all sides by bulging white cumulus, shifting constantly in the wind. Unbidden, Pallor grinds to a halt. I slam my heels into his sides, urging him back into the cloud cover, when I realize why he's stopped. He is shuddering with hawking, painful gasps, different from any he's ever made before. The sound fills me with alarm. "Pallor," I say, "easy. You're all right. Just breathe." I feel him straining beneath me, and at the same time his mind strains toward me, and I realize that the thin barrier between us is something he's fighting to break through. Pallor is straining for a spillover. Disregarding all of his training, all our habits of separation, all the distance that I've always asked him to keep. Through what's left of the barrier, I can feel his anger at our weakness, his humiliation at the retreat, his horror at the idea of defeat, his determination, like mine, that we must at all costs win. Beyond all that, something else. A strange fear and excitement about something very close to happening, and with it, the desperate need for me. "Stop! Stop doing that!" He seeks the spillover desperately, his mind pressing with urgent need into my own, and I struggle to hold him out. He ripples and stalls, and we hover,
exposed in this sun-pierced clearing amid the cumulus. A shadow passes across us. It's Annie bearing down on us from above, Ayla's wings close to her sides to speed her descent. Palor rears up to meet her, his whole body still convulsing, his growl half a hacking splutter, like a cat attempting to be sick. There's a split second when Palor and I realize that they're in range, that we're exposed, and that Ayla has opened her jaws to fire. We're about to lose everything. The barrier between us shatters. As the spillover floods my senses, understanding fills me at last. Palor's final convulsion spasms through his body and finds its release. Sparked dragon fire streams from his mouth. We rock backward with the force of the blast. I am consumed by Palor's emotions, his exhilaration and fear and just a little pain. I am high with them. It is like nothing I've ever experienced, the rush of power, of ascendance that I share with Palor in his moment of sparking. As though the world were at our feet, ours for the taking, and we will have all of it. And as with gods, the world quaked to see them fireborn. It takes me a gasping moment to emerge from the delirium, to rein him back and tell him to hold fire. But the damage is already done. Palor's aim was true, and Annie saw Ayla, surging toward us, was within range. Fire has blanketed them. Ayla is stalling, her wings beating dully against the draft. Annie, astride her, is completely still. Her armor is blackened from head to foot. Steam and smoke rise from cracks of flame suit exposed beneath as the cloud vapor evaporates and the outer layer of the suit burns. Sparked dragonfire, undoused and at full heat, is enough to kill a rider. Flame suit or no, armor or no, I am all at once sick with fear. Annie, I call. The high of the spillover is fading fast. Palor is still with me, but now he's descending from his elation and beginning to feel my numb and growing terror. Ayla rocks on a gust, and Annie's helmeted head lolls sideways, limp. I force myself to think, Ayla. Look at Ayla. Ayla's slitted eyes are still dilated, her snorts are full of anguish and fear. The signs of a dragon sensing its rider's pain. The signs of a dragon whose rider is still able to experience pain at all. Annie's there. Unconscious maybe, but alive. Relief floods through me. Annie, wake up! You need to open your coolant valves! There's no response. Fine, we'll just get to the ground fast, I think, reining Palor in, nudging us down. But Ayla makes no move to follow us. And when I turn back to her, I realize she's convulsing now too, just as Palor was moments ago. Of course, because once one dragon in the fleet sparks, it spreads. And Ayla's next. My mind still melded to Palor's, I feel his perception of her change on a level that's immediate and primal. He is suddenly aware of her in a way he never was before. And then, perhaps again it's Palor noticing, or perhaps it's the sounds I myself hear, I realize that Ayla's shudders and retches are not only frightening her as they did Palor, they're also hurting her. And I remember that sparking, in some cases, and particularly with females, can hurt. Ayla is in pain. And Annie is unconscious, tethered to her like a ragdoll. Her coolant valves closed and the ground still far away. Every moment we lose, while Ayla struggles to hack up the flames that her body spasms to produce, is a moment longer Annie goes without treatment for burns that could kill her. The solution feels at once insane and inevitable. I seize my boot knife from its sheath and cut the leather straps that hold my legs to the stirrups. They're the only protection I have should I lose hold of Palor from falling to my death thousands of feet below, and I inhale sharply as a wave of vertigo hits me. The distance to the ground, the tiny city and arena and palace below that I'm used to thinking of only passingly, transform in an instant into something deadly. Palor has flown as close to Ayla as I need him to, above her, as near as he can hover over to her without their wings colliding. Ayla, twitching and convulsing, doesn't seem to notice, and Annie's in no state to notice anything. I swing my left leg over Palor's right side, both legs hanging down over his wing joint, ready to slide off.
And then I think, this is insane. Ayla will throw me. She'll throw me at 5,000 feet. But in answer, something else inside me rises up, unbidden. A feeling that is at once new and feels at the same time ages old, like something I've always known but only now remembered. An echo of that delirious power that flooded my senses with Palor's spark fire. The line from the Aurelian cycle reverberates, fortifying and intoxicating. And as with gods, the world quaked to see them fireborn. I steel myself. If she bucks me off, I tell Palor, catch me. For the first time in my life, I've spoken to him in dragon tongue. And then I slide from one dragon onto the back of the other. Ayla shrieks at the sudden weight, tosses her back upward in rejection of it, but I've landed, sure, astride her behind Annie, and I'm able to seize the pommel of the saddle while she bucks. I wrap one arm around Annie. In the years since I've last held her like this, she's grown from a child into a woman, but her body still, in this moment, seems too small, too fragile, and her armor is smoking, still burning hot. And then I lean forward and run a hand down Ayla's neck, stroking her with firm fingers, willing her to calm. It feels wrong, deeply wrong, to touch another's dragon like this, and I know Ayla feels the same about me as I do about her. Easy, easy, I'm trying to help her. You know us, Ayla. Palor circles beneath us, and through our lingering spillover I sense his fear for us and his continuing elation at his spark fire, and still that humming wild awareness of Ayla. And I sense through him that she is aware of him too, that his presence comforts her. Ayla's whimpering, but to my amazement she doesn't buck again. With one hand, trembling, I begin to open the coolant valves on Annie's helmet, her shoulders, her arms, her back. Annie remains unresponsive in my arms, light and limp, but I can feel the temperature of her suit lowering as the coolant flows through it. My other hand is still stroking Ayla's neck as she balks with pain. It'll be over soon, Ayla. I know it hurts. I think of Palor, of his straining need to spill over, to be with me, for his release. She needs Annie, and Annie's not here to help her through it. Annie, you've got to wake up. But it will mean waking to pain. I'm opening coolant shafts along her hips, her thighs, her calves. I can smell burning leather, and under that, burning hair. Her braid, I realize with horror, is gone, reduced to a stub of charred strands visible beneath the neck of her helmet. I've done this to her, to Annie, my Annie. And the only thing I felt as I did it was euphoria. I'm so sorry, I'm so sorry. The words are choking out of me,